This is Dr. Richard Barone. I am conducting an orchestra interview with Ron Milam. We're continuing now. Today is June 28, 2005, and it is 1:06 p.m. Central Standard Time. We are again together in the Vietnam Archives Oral History Interview Room. Ron, we were about to get to where you were going into the Army, and I wanted to ask you a couple kind of overarching general questions, and we were touching on this yesterday as we finished, but I wonder if you could, we talked about you as a child of the 50s, and I wonder if you could make some comments on the overall feeling from your perspective in the 1950s and 60s, and especially going into the Army in 68, you know, when you're kind of finishing grad school and you've made these decisions. But make some comments about the Cold War in general and how you grew up with that, what your mentality was, and then in 68 when you joined the Army, where you were with that mentally.
I don't remember really being a classic, what I would call a classic Cold Warrior, in the sense of thinking of the Soviet Union and the Russians as being particularly bad people. Or I don't remember sitting around worrying about nuclear holocaust, even though I paid, as I mentioned yesterday, I paid very close attention to the Cuban Missile Crisis and understood the ramifications of that. So I don't recall that it was on my mind a lot, that the United States had this great enemy that we always had to be so vigilant against. In fact, I would argue that since I went to a fairly liberal university, I participated a lot in things that would maybe be looked upon as on the left side of politics, that is, going to films that sort of made fun of America's Cold War paranoia, films like The Russians Are Coming in 1966, a brilliant film, incidentally. Mm-hmm. So I don't remember that I was particularly worried that that the United States had to stop these guys somewhere. I think the Castro thing by that time had sort of died down in the sense of what it was like, say, in the early 60s with the missile crisis. Lyndon Johnson was sort of reaching out to the Soviet Union, and there were the SALT talks were just sort of the linkage between SALT and anything else we might do with the Soviet Union was sort of there. So it was during a period of time when I think the powers that be, Johnson and then later Nixon, were looking to the Soviet Union as somebody we could deal with, and if we could deal with them, then perhaps it would ease the situation in Vietnam. But I really don't remember. I think I probably bifurcated the Cold War from Vietnam.
Interesting. Looking back, I mean, looking at it today, do you know why you did that?
Not really. I think it probably was a combination of being in graduate school and being in the School of Business. Uh-huh. So I was in, even if it was a very liberal university, I was in the most conservative part of that university. I was interviewing for jobs, was offered, this was a 68, I was offered several really good entry-level positions. One was particularly with, that I recall, was with Ford, with Chrysler Corporation in market research, which my major, MBA, my major was marketing. And so I had a good job opportunity, except for the fact that they would not give me 3 years, they would give me two. But I had to be drafted and give up that third year in the Army in order to take that job. They'd hold the job for 2 years, but they wouldn't hold them for three. So I was sort of looking after that side of my life. Been married for 2 years. I just don't recall that I particularly thought that the war was real important in the global sense. It was just sort of important to me in the personal sense. I remember watching television and being concerned after the Tet Offensive that things had really picked up. But I don't remember that I drew any conclusions from that, the way that perhaps I would today, being a scholar of it. Mm-hmm. I was a spectator at that point.
Mm-hmm. today, again, looking back, do you see any comparisons between the Cold War and the war on terrorism, kind of a global struggle? Mm-hmm.
I think the war on terrorism is a very, compared to the Cold War, I think the war on terrorism is a very parochial thing. I think that we need not fear a global crisis with terrorism the way that we did the Cold War. Oh yeah, we have to worry about how people think of us and our responses to it, and we maybe even have to worry individually when we travel and things like that. But it's the war on terrorism to me is a very small thing compared to what the Cold War was, small in the sense of its impact. On the other hand, our response to it concerns me to the point where we have to figure out a way to solve some of the underlying problems that create terrorism in some of these other parts of the world, whether that's solving the fundamentalism issues in religion or our tolerance of it in the Middle East, or whether it's poverty in the underdeveloped nations. Mm-hmm. Those things have to be our concern in addition to just military action to make sure that we kill as many terrorists as we can. So I think it's in some ways it's of less of a concern to us than the other was because of the nuclear implications. But on the other hand, in terms of people's attitudes in the world towards Americans and our ability to sort of reign free in the world and to travel and do all those things, it's something that we have to deal with. But there are some social implications that we haven't yet addressed, in my opinion.
Then, in the 1950s and 1960s, before you went to Vietnam, what did you think the world opinion of the United States was?
I think in 1950, it was a them and us. There was them being the Russians, and there was us being the United States, and we were basically everything. Every move that we made was looked upon in light of our competition with the Soviet Union, and everybody lined up on one side or the other. Mm-hmm. And so the proxy wars that we fought around the world were really a matter of substitution for what we didn't want to do ourselves with the Soviet Union. And our response to all of those things was usually one of you know, thinking that we were halting the spread of communism, mm-hmm. and that the dominoes just couldn't continue to fall. Mm-hmm. Even though a lot of smart people looked at the issue and said, well, maybe it's not as monolithic as we think it is in terms of communism. Mm-hmm. To me, that was one of the great errors of our involvement, is the assumption on that we made that it was all part of this great big worldly plot. I don't think we believe that anymore as historians. We certainly don't believe that China was necessarily always looking out after the best interests of Vietnam.
Yeah.
Probably just the contrary. Certainly in Geneva that was the case. And even the Soviet Union, I think, were more looking out for their own interests. And as a result of that, if we could continue to be tied up with Vietnam, that was a good thing for them. But I think we made too many erroneous assumptions about the role of worldwide communism.
And this is Ron today talking. But looking back, or were you kind of in this line?
That's me now looking back. But it's also, I think, may have represented some of my ambivalence that I had towards the war and everything else, other than looking at it very personally in 1968.
I would like to have you discuss and comment on why you thought the United States did get involved in South East Asia. Just touched on that. And as a historian now trained in the field, you have expertise in the theories what's been put out there as the reasons, plus what's in the documents and all that. You're aware of that. But back then, were you seeing this, okay, this is a proxy war, this is part of the Cold War, or did you see it from the other camp or another camp that said, you know, this is a very unique situation where we want, for lack of a better term, you know, we want freedom on the march in Southeast Asia?
I saw it in the context of this. I saw it in the context of the Cold War. I did not see it in the context of we would go anywhere. John F. Kennedy's words,
right.
Go anywhere to preserve freedom. I didn't see it that way. I was a little bit. I think it was very, very simple in my mind that there was an attempt on the part of North Vietnam to control the country, and that was communism, and we had decided not to do that. Now, as a historian, now I look back on it and say that, you know, maybe some of our assumptions were incorrect, and we can question whether Ho Chi Minh was really a nationalist or so, a communist, and all those things. But at the time, I think I probably, like most Americans, I just thought, well, if this is what our country has chosen to do, if this is the place that we have to draw the line in the sand, and my country's chosen to do that, then so be it. I don't remember really questioning it too much. I also don't remember, however, really fearing that the next step was California. I don't remember thinking that they really were going to, that the Viet Cong were going to invade Chicago. I don't recall ever thinking that this was, that the future of the world rested on us winning in Vietnam. I think it was more a matter of that the country had chosen to assist that country in their fight against communism, and I would reluctantly become part of that. Reluctantly just meaning that I don't know that I would have been the first to sign up had there not been a draft. I was a reluctant volunteer.
Okay. I guess one of the obvious questions to ask now is, well, what if there were no draft? But I'm not really sure hypotheticals should be interesting.
Well,
in this.
No, but as let me throw in my 2 cents worth as a historian here. That is part of my dissertation. And the research that I conducted with the Army, at least, was that from the period of about 65 to 70, 65% of all the junior officers, second lieutenants, first lieutenants, and even captains, 65% of them said that they would not have joined the Army had it not been for the threat of the draft. Now, you can understand that with the second and first lieutenants, but that means that even some of those who chose to re-up would not have gone in the first place if it not have, would have not have been for the threat of draft. Now, that has nothing to do with the fact that two-thirds of all people served in Vietnam were volunteers. That I don't think those are mutually exclusive points. It's just that you have other things to do with your life. You don't go to college. Most people don't go to college hoping that they can then, when they're done, go into the service. Some do today, and thank goodness. But in those days, we all had our own lives to live. And all of a sudden, there was this barrier placed in front of us that said that when you come out of college, you'll have a decision to make. And part of that decision process has got to be, what are you going to do about your obligation to your country to perform military service? That has to be factored in. If it had not been there, if that had not been part of the decision process, then what those studies show is that 65% of the people would have gone ahead and gotten the job and stayed in private industry or done whatever they were going to do, not said, I want to go to join the military. So I can't hide that fact. I mean, it's nice to think back and say, oh, I enlisted and all this kind of stuff, but why did I enlist? That's the reason.
You had to make a decision.
Had to make a decision, yeah.
And it's interesting, we could talk about, or you could comment on the long-term repercussions of the tens of thousands who had to make that decision, literally millions, mm-hmm. and who chose to go into the military in that sense and go versus trying to evade or trying to get some kind of homeland job. Mm-hmm. and what the long-term repercussions were for the United States as far as brain power drain and potential drain. And again, that's more of a hypothetical, but this is along what you've been looking into.
Yeah, I think it was had an immediate effect on the officer corps.
In what way?
In some ways, it may have even been positive because it meant that we had the most highly educated officer corps in the history of American warfare. We did. We also had the most, even though it's not something to be necessarily very proud of in terms of the numbers, but it was the most racially and ethnically diverse officer corps that we've ever had up to that time. It was the most socioeconomically diverse because it forced everyone that was a college graduate to make that decision because you ran out of time. Now, when they put the draft, when they put the lottery in 70, I believe it was, March of 70, is that about right? When they put the lottery in, that changed things because then you could once your birthday was passed, you could go ahead and do whatever you wanted to do with your life and not have to worry about going in. But at the time that I had to make my decision, it forced us to put that as part of our decision process.
Do you resent that today? Do you resent that barrier being placed there? I mean, you're growing up.
No, as a matter of fact, I don't. In fact, I'll take it one step further and say that I am probably, at this point in my life, I am probably more a believer in universal service, not conscription, but I am a believer in universal service. I would never be for conscription again, because I think it produced the kind of military that doesn't serve our nation best. But I am in favor of universal service, either by requirement or by incentive, whichever way it would make the most sense. And I think that men and women should be have the obligation to serve at least one, but maybe even 2 years of time doing something for their country, whether it's a Peace Corps, whether it's hospitals, whether it's EMS, whatever it is that is different than just going out and making as much money as you can and getting along with your life. And then you can choose, in my world, it would be, you choose at any time between 18 and 30 and you take your 2 years and you do it. So I do believe in universal service. I don't resent it. What I think I resented more was that, looking back on it, is that so few of us did it. So few of us, there was others that figured out ways to not do it. I mean, 2.7 million served, and the pool was about 24.8 or something. you can take out a lot of those that could never have, but it was still a very small percentage. The Chance and Circumstance book is very clear on the numbers, and you get down to it, and your chances of going were about 1 in 10 or something like that, and yet I did. And so those other 9, if there's any resentment, it's about that more than it is that I did.
With your permission, of course, I would like you to comment on what you think today. You talk about this as who you were then, but today, why you think the United States was in Vietnam, but maybe we should wait until right before you're
okay,
deployed.
Okay, that's fine.
And we'll talk about where you were and your thinking at that
okay,
point.
Okay, because it may have changed when you get me through my basic and everything.
Exactly. I want to see. So you mentioned that that Maxine's family was pretty much anti-war.
Yes, yes.
They let you know this, but not directly to your face.
Her parents, her immediate family, her parents were not really, didn't take an active role in anything, but her two sisters and her brother-in-law were incredibly active, as I said, and
right.
Actually bankrolled some of the trips and things.
Right. And your parents, your mother was a mother, you said,
yes.
And your father was, having served, he understood to a point?
He understood, but I think he was at that point, by 1968, summer of 68, I think he was quite disappointed in the conduct of the war. I don't know, being a Navy man, I don't know if he paid as much attention to it as he would have if he were an Army, a former Army officer. But I think he was beginning to question the conduct of the war and when it would end and those kinds of things.
Based on what you told me about him, he did keep up with all.
Oh, absolutely.
And you did too.
Yes.
Would you all discuss it by the telephone?
I don't recall that we did. We lived in the same town, so we saw each other on Sundays. Every Sunday, when we would go to church and then go to their house after church. I don't remember having long discussions about the war. We had long discussions about politics.
Right.
But it was almost as if we accepted our country's decision to be there. And we didn't, I know this, we never sat around and talked about whether we should have. We were both, and maybe we're like that today too, we're both more practical than that. And that's an exercise in futility. The better question is, what are we going to do about the fact that we're here? And that's always the way we approach things. So we probably didn't talk too much about those aspects of it. But I do remember that as it got closer to my time to go in, I think that perhaps part of the reason we didn't talk about it was kind of what I touched on yesterday, and that is that I figured that if I was going in July of 68, that with a 3-year commitment, by the time I really had to go, it'd be over.
Mm-hmm.
I think we believed that. I mean, why not? The talks were starting.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Things are heading in that direction. Mm-hmm. Before we get you to basic, tell me what your thoughts were of Lyndon Johnson as a president. You touched on him already a little bit before, describing him as being a Democrat from Texas, maybe a little bit different in the way your father saw him and the way you saw him. But tell me what you thought then as LBJ as a president and then as a wartime president.
Well, let's talk a little bit about 1968. That's probably because there are some personal issues here that probably need to be addressed because
okay.
They may have impacted on our thinking.
Okay.
In February of 1968, I was kind of seeing my light at the end of the tunnel in terms of my degree. I was going to graduate in June, and I could see that getting close. And I talked yesterday a little bit about my having to go through the enlistment process and choosing the Army and the getting out of the non-combatant arms and all that kind of stuff. But in March of 68, just a couple of weeks before Lyndon Johnson decided not to run, my little brother, who was 16 years old at the time, was stricken with testicular cancer. And He was just a sophomore, I believe. Maybe he was a junior. I guess he was a junior in high school. And it was absolutely devastating to us because at that time, testicular cancer had an 80% death rate. It was one of the worst that you could get for a young man. We didn't have the conditions to cure it or to even to arrest it. And so my brother was stricken with cancer. And on the night that LBJ decided not to run, we found out about that. And I can remember being on the telephone with my father telling me that Mike had been diagnosed with this cancer. And my father called me during the election, I mean during the speech. He didn't call to talk about Lyndon's speech. He called to talk about my brother. I wasn't living home, of course. I was living up in with my wife, and I remember my father saying, as he's talking to me. First of all, it was highly irregular that my father would not be watching the speech
right.
of something this important.
He called during the middle of the speech,
and he said to me, "Did Johnson just say he's not running?" And he said that to my mother, and I think I or to me both, and I had it on.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, I think he just said that. And then we went right back talking about my brother. So this very significant event that would have been the talk of our family any other time was no longer very important because of our own personal situation. So over the next 3 or 4 days, Mike was taken into the hospital, and they had to do some preliminary testing to decide what the process would be, because no one knew for sure how to handle this particular problem. And then, of course, the very next weekend, while my brother is in the hospital, Martin Luther King is assassinated. And it was the same kind of thing. I can remember sitting in my brother's room on the day after the assassination, as I recall, was on a Thursday night, and this would have been on a Friday. And while my brother is in the hospital there, and I'm dealing with him, I'm watching all of this on television. And again, one of the most significant events in American history. And yet, at that moment in time, it was less important to me than my brother's illness. Well, that story has a happy ending in that my brother survived that bout with cancer, survived another bout with cancer, and bouts with a whole lot of other major problems in his life, and is still alive today. So it has a happy ending in that sense. So when you ask me what was my opinion of Lyndon Johnson, it's a little bit clouded by those events.
Did you think of that event first? When I asked you that question, did you go to that phone call?
Well, I've been teaching that, of course, as you know, these last few days, and so that's all kind of been fresh on my mind. But I can't ever teach the Johnson speech and the Martin Luther King and the whole issue of 1968 without remembering my brother. It's just there. And I always ask myself, would I have reacted differently to what are the three of the most significant events in our history: the Johnson decision, the King assassination, and then the other Kennedy assassination, all within just a few months of each other. Would I have reacted differently to them, and would I have reacted differently to everything had it not been for my brother's illness? Because it may have been that because of that, and because he was younger than I was and everything, it may very likely have been that what I was about to be asked to do didn't seem necessarily so significant. Dangerous and everything, but gee whiz, my brother's got cancer, and he's probably not going to make it at 80%.
That makes a lot of sense. It makes sense of a lot more sense of what you've said up to this point.
Yeah.
That's an incredibly personal thing that happens.
Yeah.
Right on the eve of you kind of coming to this end of your one stage of your life and starting this other, however brief, but very significant stage of your life. How long did it take your brother to recover from this cancer?
Well, he recovered. They did all kinds of really aggressive treatments, including there was no chemotherapy for it those days.
Right.
They took out all of his lymph system and everything, and then I went in the Army, and I saw him again a year later. He came down for my graduation from OCS, and then I kind of paid attention a little bit as he would get his checkups and everything. My father would always send me that information while I was in Vietnam. But he survived, and I don't even remember. Back in those days, we had such little knowledge, not only of that cancer but of all cancers. But I don't recall whether we ever knew for sure when he was out of remission or when he was out of trouble. I don't even recall whether they did a whole lot of tests and everything to follow up. I do know that he was stricken again by the exact same kind of cancer 13 years later in 1981, and it was a totally unrelated cancer. And he was a sidelight. He happened to have, in 1981, he had it again. And the doctors that cured him used him, did an experimental process out of the University of Indiana, and it was the doctors who cured Lance Armstrong. It was that he, my brother, was one of their first test cases.
Wow, interesting.
So we kind of have that connection, but so I don't know for sure how I just know that every time my dad would call me or send me an email, or an email, send me a letter, he'd say, my son or my brother was doing well, and that always made me feel good.
Okay, well, back to London.
Yeah.
Yeah. That puts Lyndon Johnson in your mind in context. Tell me what your opinion was of him as a president.
I don't recall thinking that. I know that certain kinds of things that I knew he was doing sort of bothered me. When I would hear him talk about how aggressively he was involved in the military process, that bothered me.
Why?
Well, I just didn't think that. I thought that he should have allowed the military to take more of an active role in bombing targets and things like that. But I also
pre-68.
Well, I was going to say that what I don't remember is how much of that I knew at the time, mm-hmm. as opposed to what I know now. Mm-hmm. I don't remember whether he bragged about you can't bomb a shit house without me knowing it. You know, I don't know whether we knew that at the time, so that might be a little bit of backward thinking. But I do. I think I respected him as a commander in chief. The election was coming up. We knew he wasn't going to be in it. I do recall that I was not a supporter of Robert Kennedy.
Why not?
I saw him as truly the anti-war candidate, and I didn't think that at this moment in time, giving a signal to our enemy that we were going to change parties was one thing. But if we were going to change in such a way that the guy coming in is going to have a completely opposite position of where we ought to be on the war than the last guy, I didn't think that was good. I remember feeling that way during the conventions of 1968. Prior to Kennedy's death, as he was going through the primary process.
What did you think on that night in the summer of 68 when he was killed?
Again, I have vivid memories of it. I have vivid memories because I was such a political animal. I followed all the elections, and I remember watching the California primary to its end and then going to bed and then waking up. That was about June. It was, the second week of June, I believe. And I was out of school, but I was about ready to graduate, and my wife was working, so I guess we must have had the clock set for, 5:30 or 6 or something like that, and we woke up to the news. Mm-hmm. And then it was a matter of turning on the television and trying to absorb as much of that as I could. So I remember it vividly. And gee whiz, now for me, my brother was a little better by that time, so now this was maybe even more impactive on me than the other incident. But I also then, in being the practical political mind that I am, the next question, because I really did think he'd get the nomination. I thought he would be able to take it from Humphrey, even though, because winning California, and it was on to California, is that the way he said it? It was on to California. I think the California primary had not been held. Or had it just been
held? He had just been held, and he had won it.
So he did win it. So what was the next? There was another primary coming up.
I don't remember. It was on to something was his last words at the podium.
Exactly.
The hotel.
Or maybe it was just on to Chicago, because Chicago would have been in late July. So, but whatever it was, I thought that very likely he would get the nomination. And so I was already prepared to not support him.
Mm-hmm.
I think we still didn't know for sure who the other one was going to be, as I recall. I don't think we knew that it was going to be Richard Nixon, because the Republicans were still playing around between Nelson Rockefeller and George Romney, who I had supported. I actually had worked for George Romney. I had worked on his campaign for governor in 66. Mm-hmm. And supported him for president. He was a governor of Michigan, and I liked him a lot. He had just recently taken a contrary position on the war that was a little bit different. But I was prepared probably to support the Republican if it was going to be Robert Kennedy on the other side. And so Nixon was I do recall that Nixon wasn't my first choice. I was for Rockefeller or Romney, whichever one of those guys, because they represented more of the liberal wing of the Republican Party. They called it the Eastern Wing, but I thought it was the Midwest Wing as well. I thought it was the Michigan Wing.
Right.
And so I was prepared to support those people rather than the Democratic candidate if it was going to be Robert Kennedy. And as it turned out, it was Hubert Humphrey. But so I do recall that.
What do you think Kennedy would have done against Nixon? Just as a hypothetical,
I think he would have still lost, because I think that the Democratic Party at that time had to get support from the South, and the Wallace candidacy would have taken the same amount of votes from Kennedy, more so maybe even than it did. I think he would have lost. I think he would have performed even less than Hubert Humphrey, because I think Humphrey may have still gotten some of the Southern. Some of the Democrat votes. Now, I don't remember electoral college wise.
Humphrey was trounced. He did not get very much in the South.
Okay.
I don't remember the number of states, but it was
okay.
It was not. He was not successful in the South.
Because the election of 68 is not a vivid memory, as was these other assassinations, because I was in pulling guard duty the night of the Democratic National Convention, and I watched that on television. We were two on and two off, so in my two off, we had the television set going, and we saw all of that stuff that was going on in Chicago at the convention, the daily thing. So I saw that, and then the election of 68, I was at Fort Polk, Louisiana, and so I remember, I don't remember much about that, because I was, I think I may have even been in Tigerland at that time. It was that week, so those are not as clear in my mind as was the events of early 68.
Do you want to talk about just briefly what you think as a historian and personally, because you lived it, how important and how impactful 1968 was for the United States, and especially the history of the country in the 20th century?
It was an amazing year, just an amazing year. I teach it as one of the most important years in American history.
As do I.
It's just, I on so many fronts. It's not just the political front. It's the war front with the Tet Offensive. It's the political front with Johnson. It's social issues with the King assassination. And then I'll even take it further than that. It's even the summer of 68. In terms of, we lived in Detroit, Michigan, and we had just come out of the 1967 race riot. And in 1968, we were prepared to have it happen again. And most historians believe that the only thing that kept another riot from happening in Detroit, because the conditions hadn't changed any, the only thing that kept another riot from happening in 1968, it was the Detroit Tigers won the pennant. They had come close the year before.
You believe that?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think it really made a difference. The city really did come together around the team, mm-hmm. and the team was really, and unlike baseball teams today, the team was incredibly integrated. The team had had five or six starting black players, and you could literally go to a baseball game in Detroit, Michigan, and sit almost anywhere and rub shoulders with African Americans. So I think it had a big effect on keeping Detroit quiet that year, because nothing else positive had happened. The changes in terms of the government, local government, and other issues hadn't been solved. So I think it did make a difference. And then the Chicago Convention, and then the rise of from the ashes of Richard Nixon, the Wallace candidacy. I mean, all of those things are just in just unbelievable events that could have, if those events had happened over a decade, they would be powerful. Happening over a period of months is just unbelievable.
It's all within 8-9 months of each other.
Right, exactly. And then And then, you know, so that's the year that I enter the United yes. States Army. And it's not just entering the Army, but it's becoming, you know, disrupting your household. You know, now all of a sudden your wife of two and a half years is you're going to be separated physically.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all that going on too, and then personally with me, in addition to my brother's situation. So it's just an unbelievable year.
I've heard 1968 described, and I tend, when I'm teaching this, to kind of look at 1968 in the same way as you just described it. This mm-hmm. this transitional, totally impactful year
yeah.
for that had impacts for decades, even up to today.
Yeah.
But looking at 68, I've heard it described this way, that it became this flood of events and flood of major things happening, and individuals like yourself and others were kind of swept into it. Through the military, you get into the military, right. and then you kind of join that process. Now, you've been this observer, you had been a slight participant in attending the events on campus and being involved politically, mm-hmm. but you now are part of, you mentioned one of the things in 1968 is significance is the war.
Right.
And so you've now joined into this fray, for
That's
better
right.
or for worse.
Yeah.
Do you kind of see 68 in that sense, that it starts and then it just widens as this flood and then
yeah I think so. You're right, I became part of the system at that point, and then what happened to me as a result of the decisions that I made regarding 1968, I was in some ways no longer in control of them.
Right.
I was in control of day-to-day activities that may keep me alive, but the bigger issue am I employed by the Chrysler Corporation, or am I just the husband to Maxine? Bottom line is, I'm not employed by Chrysler, and I'm hardly a husband. I'm being swept through this chain of events,
mm-hmm.
and I better just hang on and do the best I can. So there was probably a reluctance on my part in that sense, but there's no point in looking back.
Tell me about your induction and that process of getting into the Army.
I remember going down to the AFES station.
Can you spell that for the transcriber?
AFEEE is stands for Armed Forces Examining and Entrance Station.
Okay.
And this one happened to be at Fort Wayne, in Fort Wayne, in Michigan, down, is that what we call downriver Detroit. And I remember going into the building. I remember Maxine taking me down there, dropping me off in front of the building, and I remember listening on the music that we were listening
really?
To at the time. The last song that I heard was "And Here's to You, Mrs. Robinson." Jesus loves you more than you can know. From The Graduate,
uh-huh.
Simon and Garfunkel, a song that is supposed to be a happy song. At that moment, it wasn't. So when I hear that song today, I don't think happy thoughts. I think sad thoughts.
Do you think of that day at the?
It's just as vivid as it can be. She drove me down in our 1968 Camaro, and then I walked away. And you know, they said, "Don't bring anything." Bring what you're wearing, and it'll all be shipped home in the bag that you're carrying. So I didn't carry much. I had only been on an airplane once in my life. This was 68, June of 68, and I had been on an airplane in 1956. I was on one of the first jet commercial aircraft, a 707 or a DC-8 or whatever it was at the time. But that's the only flight I'd ever been on. So this
was. Why did you fly earlier?
A vacation. My dad traveled a lot, and he'd been flying a lot, so he flew the whole family down to Missouri to see my grandparents.
Okay.
So that was a big deal. And I was, 12 years old. So now all of a sudden I'm 20. I guess I was 23, or just turned. I guess I was 22, not quite 23. I would be 23 in November.
Is this in Detroit?
In Detroit, yeah. So we flew. I remember after all, laying around all day long. I remember taking the oath. And I remember just sort of laying around waiting for us to be put on a bus to take us out to the airport. And to be on, to, and that was kind of exciting, thinking of flying on this airplane that I'd only done one time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to fly to Fort Dix, New Jersey. But before all that happened, they came around. We were upstairs in this like balcony, I remember, in this gymnasium thing. And the guy came up and said, wanted to let you know, and a lot of these people were draftees. Most everyone was draftees. There was a handful of us that were on this college option plan to mm-hmm. go into OCS. But most everyone was a draftee. And they came upstairs and they said, hey, you just got a call that the Marines need 25 men. Anybody want to go down and join the Marines? What they said was, you can hold your same two-year commitment. So that was unusual because the Marines were able to get all the men they needed by requiring a third year. But they were going to, they did that off and on for, in 68, I believe, they would go to certain places and they'd say, if you've got draftees that are willing to sign up to be a Marine, we'll only hold them to 13, so we'll only hold them to 2 years. I wasn't interested in that.
Why?
I don't know for sure why. I think I still was thinking that this MBA was going to end up in the finance corps, and I don't believe I thought the Marines would give me the same opportunity to be to use my education.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question, Ron. Don't answer it if you don't want to. What did you say to Maxine when you walked away? Do you remember what you?
I'll see you soon. We've never believed in goodbyes. We've always been people that know that goodbye is kind of a silly term, that you never really say goodbye, so we just don't. So I said, I'll see you soon. And I did. It was 12 weeks, but I think I finally saw her in 12 weeks. But we truly thought that this was just the next step in our lives and that we'd get through it. And you know, I was an older guy. I was 23, and you know, I mean, I'd had a lot of education. And I had a graduate degree, and most everyone who was sitting around me was 18. So I felt like the old man, even though I was fairly young. But compared to them, I was older.
When was this in 68?
It was in July. I think I actually went in July 7th or something like that. I know it was the week before the All-Star game. And that was Detroit's big year, so Detroit had all these guys on the All-Star team.
Were you a Tigers fan?
Yeah, big Tigers fan.
Still?
Absolutely. Yeah, still. We're not around there anymore, but I still follow them. Yeah, in fact, I missed the 68 World Series because of being in the Army.
Something I'm sure you haven't forgiven the Army for. Because <Yeah. laughs>
right.
It happened
in 84,
84
and
right.
I was there in 84. But, yeah, it's been a long time.
So you are, everything is a green light here. You've made your decisions. You have followed your kind of prescribed plan. You've researched all your options. You've chosen the one that would benefit you and Maxine the most.
Yes.
And you still serve your country and meet your obligation, and you go forward with your life. And perhaps you don't have to go to Southeast Asia. Tell me about the plane flight, and I want you to keep in mind, if you would, when is the first time that it hits you that I'm going to Southeast Asia? That's going to be only down the
way
line.
Way down the line, yeah, way down the line. Even, I can remember, well, we flew there. Dix was, we got there at 2 in the morning or something by the time they flew to Philadelphia, and they bussed us into Dix, and it was one of those deals where they kept us up all night long filling out forms,
mm-hmm.
and then we had to go get our uniforms, and the very worst part, of the entire experience, including everything that happened after that, OCS and everything else, there was nothing lower in my life than having my head shaved.
Really?
Because I had really long below my collar. I was a hippie. I was a hippie-looking guy. I was one of, even though I was in the school of business, I loved long hair and I loved the style. And I can remember that those barbers just loved every minute of guys like me. And when they started shaving my head, and that first run right mm-hmm. down the middle, which they just loved, it just bothered me no end. I think that may be about the only time I cried in the whole 3 years. I mean,
really?
It was just terrible. Because it was such a... hair has always been really important to me, and I'd had all these fights with my father growing up about long hair, and I respected so much those who had the individuality to wear their hair long, like Elvis Presley and later the Beatles. I thought that was really neat, and what was it wasn't just that it was neat that people had long hair and they were willing to do it, but it was neat that adults didn't like it. And so I really respected people that, so I was that person. And so I carried that right into the Army. But when they did that, then they had me. You know, I'd lost my individuality. I also am a person that I'd always felt like didn't look very good in short hair, and because my ears stick, I have big ears and they stick out from my head. And when you take the hair, you take the hair away from the ears, it makes it even more so. So I don't think that aesthetically it was something that I wanted to show, but it bothered me a lot. And then when they said that'll be 75 cents, then that was even worse. You had to pay for that, and. So it really bothered me, and then the going through the uniforms and all that kind of stuff. But I remember trying to make some friends. I've always been kind of a loner when it comes to that sort of thing. So making new friends, I mean, it wasn't that it was hard to do, but I wasn't very trustworthy. My whole company, most of the company, was made up of boys off the street of Newark, New Jersey. A lot of guys that were in there that were given the option by the judge of going to jail or going to in the Army. We had in our battalion, we had Emerson Boozer, that played for the New York Jets, was in our unit, and Cassie Russell, that had played for University of Michigan. So that was kind of cool. And I had the satisfaction. I was horrible. I was just horrible in basic training in terms of physical preparedness. But my one thing I felt good about is I didn't get recycled, but I did get put into a special PT group to get me up to where I could pass the test, and in my group was Cassie Russell.
Really?
And this guy was, you know, 6'8", but he was a poor athlete, not a poor athlete, he was just in poor shape because of his size.
Yeah.
I was also in poor shape because of my size, but I was too small, he was too big. So I always thought that was kind of neat. But I remember all of that yelling and screaming at us, and everything was really, really hard on me. I started questioning whether I was really cut out for it.
So you didn't react very well to that?
No.
Military discipline?
No, I didn't. I didn't at all. Not the first 2 or 3 weeks. And the physical part was really hard for me because I think I was out of shape. I weighed 125 pounds.
Were you a smoker?
No. No, I never smoked, and I'd been a cross-country runner, but between the time of high school when I was a runner and 5 years later, after graduate school, I hadn't done anything physical. And I literally had 125 pounds. I literally had no chest. I had no pectoral muscles whatsoever. I was skinny in all respects, and the Army's physical training test didn't have anything on it that I was good at. I wasn't good in the low crawl. I wasn't good in the overhead bars. I didn't have any arm. I wasn't good at, we didn't do the grenade throw, then they did the 75-yard man carry. I had carry a guy my weight. First of all, there wasn't anybody by my weight. I was so small. So you had to carry a guy bigger than you running with him 75 yards. And then you had to do the run, dodge, and jump. That was not too bad. Then you had to do this, you had to do a 1 mile run in combat boots. And I'd been a runner. I was a good runner in high school, but I was just totally out of shape. And you had to run this thing, and you had to do it in like 8:30 or something like that. And I think my first time I did it in 9:30 or something. I run faster than that now. I mean, I was really in bad shape. And the Army knew it, and so the threat was to recycle you. And if you get recycled, you know, you push back at least 4 weeks. In basic training, you go back 4 weeks and start over. And the fear of that is that then it follows you all the way through. And I had an OCS class that would be after basic, then after AIT, that I would need to be ready for.
Right.
And if I wasn't there, then my fear was that I wouldn't make them, that the next one they may not let me in, and then that upsets everything.
Sure.
So the Army had a very good plan that, I mean, the Army does, even back then, they did a great job with, if you were small, they would make you big, and if you were big, they would make you small through diet and exercise mm-hmm. And everything else. And so I give them a lot of credit for building me up, because I went from not passing the first PT test, almost maxing it 8 weeks later, and I went from 125 pounds to 148 pounds
wow.
in 8 weeks, and it was all muscle. I mean, I even in after 8 weeks, I was in really good shape, better shape than I'd ever been in my life.
Mm.
Lots of pork chops and mashed potatoes for lunch, and mm-hmm. chicken and mashed potatoes for supper.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember thinking the food was bad. I actually developed an appetite, and I think once I got over the hump of realizing that I could do this, and it took about a month, I'm going to say a month.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I ever bought into all the pomp and everything that went on, and the drill and ceremony was not my best thing. I didn't really buy into that as much, but I started paying attention a little bit, and then I started really recognizing the quality of the pedagogical skills, I guess we would call them today, of the training staff.
Mm-hmm.
And I can, even to this day, I can remember the faces, if not the names, of so many of my drill, either the drill instructors or those that instructed us in certain phases of mm-hmm. them. And I was firing a gun for the first time in my life. I wasn't a gun person. My family didn't have guns. I'd never been hunting or anything like that. So this was all new to me.
How were you with the rifle?
I was not real good with the M14. Bothered me a lot because it had such a powerful recoil. And I was so small as I was learning it that I flinched a lot. So I think I scored in the, I was probably sharpshooter on the M14, the second rung. And then when we, at the very end of basic training, they introduced us to the M16. And then we had the M16 all through Fort Polk. And I was much better at the with the M16.
Mm-hmm.
When we got to OCS, we went back to the M14. And so I had to relearn the M14. And I ultimately got to where I could handle that weapon pretty well, too. But in the beginning, it was all very strange to me.
Did you try to stay under the radar? Or as the oldest, did you stick out?
I think I did stick out a little bit. And I was given the opportunity to lead. I was given the opportunity before I even had a uniform to be a squad leader.
Really? Because of your age?
I think because of my age, yeah.
And your
yeah.
degrees, perhaps?
Well, the degrees were interesting. The degrees were always, when about the second day of every place I ever was, whether it was at Fort Benning, whether it was at Polk later on, or then at Benning, or even later on than that, I would always, about the second day, someone would come through and say, "Hey, find me that guy with an MBA. Let's make him a clerk." And they always wanted me to come in and do the typing, and I couldn't type. Well, I was married. I didn't have to type. I had a wife that was a professional secretary. She did all that stuff for me. So I was horrible at all the things that, just because that's the typical military way that anybody that has a degree probably can do things I can't do, and one of the things they can do is type. And I was not a clerical type person in any way. And I always, but on the other hand, you know, you sometimes that's an opportunity to avoid a drill or to avoid mm-hmm. a 5 mile force march or something. But I remember basic training being a struggle for the first month, and then about the last 4 weeks, I started kind of figuring it out.
What about the leadership position? Did you take it?
I took it, but I never became I don't think I ever felt like I became a great leader. I don't think I ever felt like, oh boy, I'm good at this and I'll just keep doing it. I think I just, you're asking about being under the radar, I did believe that, I bought into the concept that we had sort of all talked about and never volunteer for anything. And so I never volunteered for anything in that sense.
Why weren't you, or why did you think you were not such a good leader? Or that you didn't?
I don't know. Maybe it's my own expectations. I think it probably was because of the physical issues, that I wasn't a good physical specimen. I got better as time would go on. My confidence level went from practically nothing in basic training to sky high before I went to OCS because I got into good shape. And I think that had a lot to do with it. But I looked at people around me and recognized that they were in better shape than I was. Mm-hmm. A lot of football players, even in tactics and small unit tactics and things like that, when we'd have training exercises, the guys that had played football tended to be better at all that stuff than I was. They'd start drawing the X's and the O's and movements and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of buying, I was trying to learn it, but I didn't really feel that I was that confident with it. That would come later, but in the beginning it wasn't there.
Yeah. Why don't we take a break?
Okay.
Okay, Ron. So I wanted to ask you, your drill instructors, you said you remember them very well. In basic, were they Vietnam veterans? Had they been in country?
We had a little bit of both. I remember the drill instructors being very good. I remember a couple of them. Sergeant Shirtless sticks in my mind. I can't remember the other
Sergeant who?
Shirtless. S-H-I-R-T-L-I-F-F. And he was not a Vietnam veteran. He was a draftee. He admitted to us, but after some time, he was just a good guy after the first few days when you have to act tough.
What made him good? What was a good drill?
For one thing, you could tell he'd gone to college. He had, at least to me, he was good. Now, maybe some of the people that weren't college graduates, smart, for one thing. He had a good sense of what was important about humanity, and he could sort of cut through the bullshit and sort of get to our level of what we were trying to do and what we were trying to learn. He didn't give the rah-rah pep talks about, I'm going to try to keep you alive and stuff, because he'd never been to Vietnam. He was just like everybody else, only he was, somebody saw something in him, rightly so, that where he could lead. And so he was real good. Then we had a couple of others that I recall were Vietnam veterans. The best ones were the older guys. My guys, they must have been as old as 35 or 36 or something, you know, who had Vietnam experience, maybe one tour over there, and could sort of now and then talk about things that were really important. But again, we're in basic training, and for me, there was no fear whatsoever that I was going to Vietnam anytime soon. I had this guaranteed option of going to OCS and all that stuff. So for me, I looked at it just kind of, I was kind of set aside to look at the whole process. But I don't remember that I hated it necessarily. After I got through the first 4 weeks, I hated the first 4 weeks. And after I got my physical hold of myself physically, then I was pretty confident about everything. Got to see my wife after 7 weeks. For some reason or other, our unit had performed real well doing something. I don't remember what it was, and we got a weekend pass from Saturday morning to Sunday night. And so I called Maxine and had her meet me in Philadelphia, and I took the bus to Philadelphia. We spent one night and a couple of days together, and that really helped me get through the rest of it. So it's not an unpleasant memory that I have about basic training. Yeah, I kind of, in a silly sort of way, maybe enjoyed it a little bit.
What do you see in your mind's eye when you think of basic? Besides your hair falling on the floor.
Yeah, that was the worst part. Once I got through the hair and the physical part, I think I was fine with basic training.
What did Maxine think about your new look?
She didn't like it. I mean, she didn't say that. Yeah. But I could tell. And I said, well, I get to grow it out in AIT. And they let you grow it. You have to have white sidewalls, but you get to grow it back on top. Mm-hmm. So I was able to do that.
Do you remember, this might be kind of a silly question, do you remember what Philly was like there in the summer of 68 during that weekend?
Not really, because we didn't spend a lot of time outside.
Yeah, I figured this much. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't remember too much about Philadelphia. Okay. Just I remember we had a good time. I do remember we ate at Alfredo's. At that time there was only two Alfredos in the world. One was in Rome, the man that, you know, Fettuccine Alfredo. Mm-hmm. One in Rome and one in Philadelphia. There's one now in Disney World, I guess. But at the time there was only two, so I think that was kind of neat. And we did have a nice meal, I do remember that. And it was, you know, to not eat army food was kind of neat.
Were you in uniform?
No, I didn't wear my uniform. I wore it to meet her. She met me at the bus station. And then I changed, and I was not necessary. I can tell you this: I was never proud to wear my uniform all the time I was in the Army.
Why?
I don't remember feeling good. I don't remember feeling that anyone in society, other than, you know, myself and my family, my wife, wanted to see me in uniform. I don't remember ever being, the only time I ever remember being proud was when I came home from airborne training before I went to OCS, and I was able to wear my jump boots with my dress greens, my class A's, mm-hmm. and only airborne guys could do that, mm-hmm. and being so proud of that and noticing that nobody cared in the airports, nobody cared. So, no, it wasn't something that I was proud of.
Is that a product of the time?
Yeah, yeah. It sure is. It sure was.
What do you think now?
I feel bad that I felt that way. We went to Europe a month ago, and we were in the Dallas airport. I haven't traveled a lot through airports since I've been in academia, and I haven't done a lot since I've been in the last couple of years of the war in Iraq, but it was so interesting to see all these soldiers either going or coming back from Iraq, mm-hmm. wearing fatigues, yes. wearing their camos. And first of all, we were never allowed to wear anything except Class A's, summer or winter, in public places. You could wear fatigues on post in the commissary and things, but you couldn't even in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, when I was with the 82nd Airborne Division, I could only wear my fatigues. You couldn't stop anywhere. I used to ride my motorcycle back and forth, and you couldn't even stop other than for gas between Fort Bragg and your home. You couldn't stop at a civilian grocery store if you were wearing fatigues. That was the rule. You had to either be in a dress uniform or in civilian clothes. And I saw all these guys in their camos, you know, and I was so proud of them. And we spent so much time going up to guys. I'd say going or coming. I'd either say thank you or good luck. Mm-hmm. And it was really neat seeing them traveling. But we didn't do that. We didn't feel that way during the Vietnam era at all.
We can touch on that when we get to present day stuff. Talk about post-Vietnam. Anything else about basic that you want to comment on?
No, I think it was, I remember it was in the summer and it was hot, and the Army had that great, one of the really dumb things that they did, because we didn't know any better, was that you had to take these salt tablets.
Right.
And we would scarf down those salt tablets, and, you know, your green fatigues would turn white from all the sweat, you know, mm-hmm. all that salt sweating out of your body. It's mm-hmm. no wonder it didn't kill us. And every once in a while, somebody would die in training. And they'd have these rules that they had. If it was a certain temperature, then they would lower the flags to certain levels. And if it was all the way, if it was just a little bit from the top, that meant that the post flag, not the United States flag. But if it was a certain level, then that meant the uniform would be full roll your sleeves to here. If the flag
and you're
is
in a game at your wrist.
Yeah, depending. Whatever the temperature and the heat index, they didn't call it that then, was, it would depend on how it would determine how you, what uniform you wore for that day. And every once in a while, then they'd say, okay, we were supposed to go on a 5-mile march today, but instead we're going to go to your barracks and read a book. and it would be because somebody died.
And were you like, all right.
Yeah. Screw him. thank goodness for him when we get a day off. Uh-huh. And I say it happened a lot. It probably happened once. My memory is that it happened a lot, but I doubt that it did. Mm-hmm. But I do know that it did happen at least once during my 8 weeks over there. And it was always the rumor was that, you know, well, this real sergeant just made him do too many push-ups and all that stuff. Rumor mill is so terrific in the military. But I don't remember. Other than that, I think it was. I think basic was well done. I think the Army did a pretty good job in that 8 weeks of preparing, not preparing people for Vietnam. That comes with the advanced training, but just preparing people to get used to the military society, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
What'd you do in between basic and AIT?
Nothing. We had no time off at all. We literally graduated at 9 o'clock in the morning, and no one. My family didn't come to graduation.
Why not?
Well, because I knew I was going to AIT and we were going to take off that afternoon. There would have been no time to see her at all. I think I saw her the weekend before. And so we graduated in the morning and we got on an airplane and they flew us to Fort Polk, Louisiana. Now, when you got your orders for Fort Polk, mm-hmm. if you were at Fort Dix, with the exception of those of us going on to OCS, if you got your orders for Polk, you knew where you were going next. Fort Polk was Tigerland, mm-hmm. and that meant Vietnam. And so you have this, all these guys that their next stop is going to be Vietnam on their way to Fort Polk.
Is this when
morale was really low for them? Wasn't bad for me because again, I knew I was at least a year away from anything, and I knew that I was reasonably certain that I would get good training, because all through basic training they'd say, if you get orders for Polk, you know you're going to Nam. And if you get orders for Polk, you'll get really good training. It's tough, man. Tigerland, next to Vietnam, Tigerland's the worst thing you'll ever go through. And so you get this feeling that, wow, I'm really going someplace that's important, that it has this incredible reputation. So, and I'd never been to Louisiana, I don't believe, at that time. No, I'd never been to Louisiana. And so it was kind of exciting, and like mm-hmm. I say, I had the safety net of OCS and everything, so I didn't have to worry about anything. So we went down to Fort Polk. Leesville, Louisiana.
Right. Tell me about what that experience was, getting off the plane and going.
Fort Polk was hot. And even though it was fall, it was hot. It was September. And it really was, you could tell, it was all about Vietnam. And at our introduction, as they talked to us about it in orientation, they told us, it wasn't a matter of you might go to Vietnam, you will go to Vietnam. Everybody that goes to Fort Polk goes to Vietnam. So they were telling all of us that, and of course we're all snickering because there was about 50 of us that were going to OCS. We knew mm-hmm. that, so we felt pretty good about ourselves. Mm-hmm. We were going to get to experience what it was like to be prepared to go someplace where once you get without having to worry about going there. Mm-hmm. And of course, Leesville, Louisiana was known as just one of the wildest places in the country. You could get anything you wanted. You could get any drug, you could get any kind of liquor, you could get any kind of woman. Whatever you wanted, it would be there in Leesville. Mm-hmm. And so those of us that were going to OCS, we had a good time there. The Army's attitude in AIT seemed to be, you give us a good Monday through Friday and maybe a Saturday morning. And if your unit performs well during the week, then you're off at noon on Saturday and you don't have to come home till Sunday night. And they did a good job of motivating people that way. Now the problem was for the guys that were going to Vietnam, they had to, knowing they were going, there were a lot of real head cases there, the guys that were trying to figure out ways to avoid going. So they didn't, their incentive to not to not go AWOL and stuff was not as high as ours. But we left every weekend. There was a bunch of us, and we had one guy who lived up in Greenville, Mississippi, so we'd go up to his place. Mm-hmm. We had some other friends who lived in Alexandria, Louisiana. We'd go to his place. Maxine came down twice from Detroit, and we were able to spend some time together. In fact, we watched the World Series, I remember, from bed in Alexandria one weekend. So for me, Fort Polk was great.
Do you want to talk about off-post activities in which you
Yeah, we would go in and observe all those crazy things, and they were crazy things. Golly, prostitutes everywhere, selling it on the streets, selling it everywhere. And again, you know, you're talking about 18-year-old guys that haven't been away from home very much. As an old 23-year-old married man, it was a little different. It was fun to watch. It was really good training. Fort Polk was good training in all respects for Vietnam.
Can you describe that, elaborate on that?
Well, the famous part is Tigerland.
Right.
The last week that they take you through Tigerland, and we got to go through that. We spent that week of bivouac and the search and evade, search and destroy, and all those things, and then trying to escape from a prison of war camp. And the one thing I do remember on that particular exercise is that there was two of us, my buddy and I, were groups of two. I remember we had the first...
This is Tigerland?
This is Tigerland. And you know, this is where it gets a little murky with me. What I'm going to describe is either Tigerland or it's the same thing in OCS, because we did something that was similar to this. And I may have part of my stories mixed up. But the one thing I do remember is we had to kill a chicken. And so we had all these guys from Detroit and cities, and they'd never been around chickens, and you had to kill a chicken, and then you had to clean it up, and put it in a number 10 can and cook it, and you had to do that in like 10 minutes or something. You know, just the idea was to be able to eat quickly off the forage off the land. And I remember I was the only one in my unit that had ever killed a chicken. My grandma was a chicken farmer up in Missouri, and I hadn't killed a chicken since I was six, but I didn't forget how. And all these guys were so squeamish about killing the chicken, so I do remember the killing of the chicken.
How'd you kill a chicken?
You did. Snack.
You did?
Yeah, I did it. Shoot.
And so you just ran it?
Yeah, you just like that, and of course the body goes that way, and you got the head in your hand. And everybody thought that was so gross, and I didn't even know why everybody thought it was so gross. It just was no big deal. And I know they tell you all these other ways that you could do it with your bayonet and all this kind of stuff, but I did it the way Grandma taught me.
Right.
I do remember that. And then I remember that we were supposed to, evade these pursuers all night long. And my buddy and I got either lost, I don't know whether we were lost or what happened, but we were totally, we got off post.
Now, were you moving in pairs?
We were a pair, yes. Okay. The evade was a pair, and then the idea was they would catch you, and they would take you to a POW camp, and they would interrogate you and put you through all these ropes and everything.
What kind of... ammo were you using, blanks? What was it?
Well, we normally use blanks, but we didn't have weapons. We were weaponless on this particular exercise.
Okay.
But I remember we got lost and we got off post and we had to hitchhike. And so we did.
Wow.
We literally hitched back, and the guy took us.
Were you all painted up?
Yeah, we were painted with some stuff. We went through that whole thing with painting our faces up. We were wearing, remember, we weren't wearing steel pots. We were wearing, just our fatigue caps. And they took us, so we ended up, we were hitchhiking at 2 or 3 in the morning, exercise was supposed to end at 4 or 5, and we're off post. So we had the...
Let me ask you, when you get off post, are you like, oh shit, we're off post?
We didn't know. We sort of thought we saw cars going by. You know, it was like outside of an artillery range,
yeah.
Where the hell, out there somewhere.
Yeah. How did you get there?
I have no idea, it was dark.
we
were evading.
You did a really good job of evading.
So now we're like out there, and this woman picked us up, and we...
That's brave of her.
Oh, yes, it was. We said, hey, we're lost. We don't know where we are, and can you take us someplace? Well, she took us to this bar, And it was, it must have been before 2, because the bar would close at 2, I guess. And we took, went to this bar, and we drank beer for a couple of hours. And then she took us back to where we could at least know where the camp was, and we could sort of come back in and act like we had been successful in evading. And they gave us all this credit for having not gotten caught.
You are kidding.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was terrific.
And you got a few beers. And
Oh, yeah. We had a great night. And see, that's the kind of thing that we didn't worry about that, because we weren't really trying to learn how to evade, because we were going to go to OCS for 6 mm-hmm. months, and then we were going to do this other stuff and become officers. Mm-hmm. So we were learning to do stuff that might help us someday, but it didn't have an immediate need that we saw, so we just kind of had a good time. And it was really an enjoyable 8 weeks.
What do you mean by that? I'm trying to figure out how to ask that question in a more sophisticated way, but I've heard so many stories of the opposite, that Fort Polk was so hard, and AIT was so hard, and you know, I was in great shape, but, and I thought I knew what I was doing, but, and the, you know, the stories of Vietnam, my DIs in AIT were vets, and they scared us, and they did this and that. Tell me what you mean by enjoyable.
Well, I think it has to be understood in the context of that I'm not going to Vietnam anytime soon, so
right.
I'm an observer as much as anything. I'm a participant, but I can have fun with this, essentially. And I thought the training was absolutely excellent. I thought the guys that were going were getting the very best training. It was kind of neat training. I mean, it was real training. When the guy stood up there and gave a lecture on the M79, you knew probably you were going to use that M79 someday soon, the guys that were really doing it.
Yeah.
And they knew. So it was effective training in all respects. Our drill sergeant's name was Bobby Aaron. He was Hank Aaron's cousin. At least he said he was Hank Aaron's cousin. Who knows, right?
Right.
But we called him the drill daddy, this African-American man. And he was just terrific. He
called him the drill daddy to
his face. Drill daddy to his face, drill daddy. Yeah, he said, you can call me the drill daddy. And he was just as cool as he could be in all respects. And he had had 2 tours in Vietnam. And he didn't try to scare you. He'd just say, you know, I hope I can keep you alive and this kind of stuff. He was just terrific in all, everything about the man. I just loved him. And so one of the observations that I made in AIT, and later would see the same thing in OCS, is so many of the drill sergeants and so many of the cadre teaching all of the courses were African American, because they were the ones that were re-upping. They were coming home from Vietnam and not getting out, because you remember in the 1960s, for an African American, the Army was the absolute, or the military was the absolute best thing they could do. Couldn't get a job in civilian life. They had respect. They had respect because of their combat experiences, and it was a great life for them.
Did you all have respect for Drill Daddy and the other African-American officers?
Absolutely. I don't remember ever having a racist feeling about that. Not even so much so with my buddies in the programs.
Is that because you're from Detroit or from the
North? I don't know. I don't know. I remember little things like, more so in LCS perhaps, but I remember little things like some of my friends from the South. I didn't have a lot of friends from the South until I went in the Army. And listening to music, and my friends from the South were listening to country music, country mm-hmm. Western music. And like my African-American friends were listening to Motown. And I understood the Motown. I had more feeling for that than I did for the country music, even though I'd been raised in Oklahoma and I liked the music, but it's just something about that Motown sound. But the surprising thing was, these guys from the South, they didn't know the Motown sound. It's like, I'm thinking, where the hell you been?
Because you did
the Supremes, you don't know the Four Tops and the Temptations and Smokey Robinson and the Marilyn, you don't know any of these things. It was almost like that music hadn't made it into Mississippi.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it.
1968, too.
Yeah.
It's been on for a few years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But apparently where these guys live, they never listened to it. So there was a feeling of camaraderie because of the music that I think I had, maybe with some of the African, the black guys more so than some of my other friends. But even then, I don't remember a lot of racism in the training unit. conference that I was in.
Even in basic?
No, I don't remember it in basic, and I don't remember it in AIT. I just don't. I don't remember it ever being a big deal. Even though, you know, I've studied since that it probably was, but it didn't appear that way to me.
Okay.
But AIT was a I was very impressed with the way we were preparing people for what they would what would follow. Good M60 training, good M79 training, no helicopter training. We got no helicopter training at all.
Why not?
I don't know. I don't know whether it was a matter of cost. I didn't get my first helicopter training until OCS.
Was that a mistake?
Yeah, probably. We were trucked out to Tigerland in Deuce and a Halfs.
It would have made it that much more real.
It would have. I don't remember it. They must have just thought that in-country training, that first 5 days of orientation in a unit would probably suffice for telling you how to get it on and off the chopper, but they didn't. Or it may have been just a matter of the chopper. They didn't have choppers in this country other than what they had at McClellan and some of the helicopter training areas that they could afford to do it in AIT. But I don't remember us ever doing anything with airborne assaults. But I do remember that Tigerland was very effective. I mean, it was a solid week of bivouac out there with search and evade, with all that stuff, you know, and it was pretty doggone good, pretty good realistic training.
How did you do personally?
I did much better than I did in basic training. I had gotten a hold of myself physically, and I was starting to feel like a real soldier. Mm-hmm. I can't say I was loving it. If you'd said, would you rather do something else than this, I probably would have been fine. But it was almost like an 8 to 10 job 5 days a week, and then if you were good, you got Saturday afternoons and the rest of the Sunday off.
Right.
So we traveled, and we went places, and almost every weekend I went to Alexandria or to Mississippi or to, like I said, I met my wife. We traveled a lot every weekend, and it was kind of neat. There's just something about it that was very positive. Again, I think because I knew I wasn't going to Vietnam anytime soon.
Yeah. Can you tell me some details of the training, the courses, the classes?
Yeah, they were. We had the small unit training, fire and maneuver training. We had training on all of the weapons. The M16 was the weapon at that point. We weren't even issued an M14, so we trained on the M16. So we had marksmanship training. I think we may have even gotten a chance to shoot a 45. I think we trained on the 45 pistol, but that I may have that mixed up with OCS because there would have been no real reason to teach it other than M79 and M60 guys all carried 45s. So they may have taught us that. We had grenade training.
Mm-hmm.
We did, you know, the PT stuff. I can remember isometric exercises were coming into vogue then. That was the brand new thing, and they were trying to teach that. And nobody got that. Nobody understood that. It didn't make any sense. Those little reflexive things, and it was almost like those yoga things. Nobody bought into that. We had hand-to-hand combat training. We did pugil sticks. That was really fun.
Did you do well with that?
No, not particularly. I'm not very aggressive when it comes to that. I tried. I put up a good show, but some of the guys just absolutely loved getting in there and beating the crap out of somebody like that. I didn't. Hand-to-hand was kind of neat because I liked hand-to-hand combat because there were these great ways of equalizing your size if you could do them correctly. And I tried to really learn how that all works because I thought that would be a good equalizer if I ever needed that.
You still remember it today?
Yeah, but you know what I remember? A little bit. But you know what I remember more than anything is bayonet training.
Really?
I absolutely can still do all that stuff with a bayonet. Yeah, I mean, amazing. Just amazing, all the stuff.
For example, what?
Well, the whole butt stroke, all the yelling, everything. I can do it all.
Just for the record, you're demonstrating that right now.
Yes, I can do it. I've done it. A few beers, I do it even better. But it stuck with me. It was amazing training. And the neat thing about AIT to me was there was virtually no harassment of the kind that we had in basic, the policing up of cigarette butts, the details, the shit details. They didn't do that. They acted like, at Fort Polk, they acted like they know what their mission is, and that's to, in 8 weeks, get these guys ready to go into combat.
And
they're
going to
take it seriously. Exactly. And if we're not training them, then let's give them some time off to enjoy life before they go. That was the attitude, and I thought it was extremely effective.
What weapon did you enjoy the most, besides the bayonet?
I thought the M16 was a good weapon.
And they had cleared up the jamming problems by now.
I thought the M16 was a pretty decent weapon. I liked it because it seemed less like a weapon to me. It, you know, being a non-gun person, it seemed more like a toy. It was made out of plastic. It was light. It kind of looked cool. Other than that long, big old M14. And when you look down the barrel of it, it just seemed to be a weapon that I personally could handle better. We were being trained in quick kill techniques at that time, where they would tape a piece of a yardstick across the top of the sights, and you were instructed on how to sight with both eyes, not a single eye, down a target, and to shoot very quickly in three round bursts. And then we did that exercise. We'd do it late in the afternoon, and then at night, when it got dark, we'd do it again at night. And the idea, and I thought that they had learned something in Vietnam about that. They had learned that that very seldom would a soldier ever sight his weapon at an enemy, that you're going to shoot from the hip, or you're going to shoot with on the way up kind of thing. And they taught effective things like make sure that you recognize that the M16 on fully automatic rock and roll will rise and go to the right.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to make sure that you shoot low at the enemy. And we know now, as a historian now, having studied some of the Viet Cong stuff that we've got, we knew that that's what the sapper said. If they didn't get you on the first burst, that you'd be fine. Just hug the ground, and an American soldier would miss you because he'd be firing this way. And so they did a good job with that. The quick kill techniques worked. The M60, we trained on the M60, got good training on the M60 machine gun.
Can you describe, Ron, I'm going to take advantage of you right now and your articulation about this, what it's like to shoot an M60 machine gun? We hear about this, we read about it, we see it in movies.
Yeah.
What is that like?
Well, in training, your targets on an M60 are usually not people. They don't have it. They use tanks because and you're using 4-to-1 ratio tracers, and so every fifth round you've got a tracer out there, and so you can sight in on something that's large like a tank, and you can see the effective range of one of these things, and it's they'll have those things sitting out there at 1,000 meters, so we're way down there.
And how far away is 1,000 meters for those listening to this?
Oh, 1,000 meters is 1,600 yards. Is that right?
I don't know.
1,600 meters. No, 1,600 meters. It's just a minute now.
Well, I didn't mean
I'm
to
thinking meters
to make you could do a conversion. I'm trying to think of just something to compare it to.
It would be the length. Let's say 1,000 meters, 100 meters. I've misspoken. It's 400 meters because it's the length of 4 football fields.
Right.
Now you can. It has an effective killing range of about 2.5 miles. So you literally can lay, arc one out there at a tank that would be that far away.
Right.
But in training, it was about 400 meters.
Why train shooting at tanks and not something smaller?
I think so you can see the effect of your marksmanship. You wouldn't be able to see it you wouldn't be able to even see a target that far out.
Right.
They wanted to be able to see the effective range. And remember, in a machine gun, you're trying to move. Yet you're trying to lay down a field of fire. That's the idea behind the machine gun. It's not really to hit something and kill it. It's to effectively lay down a wall of steel so that men can advance, That's what the fire and maneuver technique would be, using a machine gun. Now, if you are trying to use it in true combat situations, it's going to do what you're going to use it for whatever need you have at that moment, whether you're in total defense or if you're in offensive mode. And in Vietnam, in the jungle atmosphere, you'd very seldom ever have an opportunity to fire one 400 meters. But at the time, I remember the training being very effective. The big problem with the weapon is the heating up of the barrel.
Right.
And so now we had in Vietnam, we had when we went out on an operation, we carried a 60, or we always had 60s attached to our vehicles. We always carried an extra barrel, and you can change barrel. That was the best way to not worry about a barrel overheating. They were very quick change. It was very mm-hmm. easy to change the barrel.
Did they tell you, just out of curiosity, that that the enemy in Vietnam would first target that M60?
Yeah.
Try to take out the machine gun?
Yeah. That was an issue of leadership, problem with leadership. This is something that I've learned more as a historian than I did when I was actually there. But because I didn't serve in an American unit, but as I understand, in a lot of the American units, that was a real problem, because the M60 was the most important weapon in your squad, but you had to get somebody that wanted to carry it. It was heavy.
Yes.
You had to have an ammo bearer, somebody that, and you had to deal with the ammo bearer not wanting to bear ammo for that guy, or that guy not wanting him as an ammo bearer, and racial issues that come up with that, because a lot of there's been some writings of a lot of the black soldiers saying that they always felt like they were targeted to carry that weapon for racial issues. And I think brothers, Sam Goff, sort of thing, talks about that a lot. But frankly, it was a tremendous weapon. I think the M60 was a great weapon.
How about the M79?
The M79 was very effective. I didn't get a lot of training on the M79. I did take the training course in it, but I don't remember my training too much. I remember it more so when I went to Vietnam. It was a very effective weapon. We carried it all the time. Any operation we went on, we carried them in our jeeps, everything. They were just a great weapon, and you had so much versatility with them because you had the opportunity to use high explosive, to use Willie Pete, and to use CS. We even had tear gas and then flares.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just never had that new round. I never got one of those flechette rounds, the shotgun round. I never had one of those, so I don't know how effective that was. But it was a way of convincing soldiers that had to carry the M79 on an operation when they were going through the jungle. They didn't want to carry it because if you're ambushed, you've only got one round.
Mm-hmm.
So they put that flechette round in there, and they give you a pretty effective first round before you had to figure out something else to do.
Right.
So, but it was a good weapon, a really good weapon.
The tactics that were taught to you all, the maneuver, all that, was it pretty accurate for what you did see later in Vietnam? Or how far off base, I guess.
I think I would put it this way. Fire and maneuver, the ability to take a fire team with cover, with fields of fire and cover and that sort of thing. It was taught that way. I'm not sure, since I didn't serve in an American unit once I was there, I don't know whether American units used that or not. Now, I taught the same courses when I was advisor to the Montagnards, and we didn't teach it exactly the same way as it was taught in the States, because we weren't using the same kind of weapons with them. We were using old World War II weapons, more so BARs and Garands and stuff like that. But actually, I think the idea of laying down fields of fire and being able to fire and move the way that you're supposed to is probably about all you can do in that kind of training. I think they were probably more effective on defensive items, setting up of fields of fire and foxholes and coverages in your CPs and working around that. I think maybe they did a better job. I think that was maybe more apropos to Vietnam in terms of units on the move and setting up night encampments and that sort of thing.
What did they tell you about defensive positions? Because I hear this so much in interviews, veterans talking at length about their defensive positions, the night defensive position, the ambush position, and it's of how important, vitally important it is to have that thing right.
Yeah. It is important. Again, my experiences once I got to Vietnam were with different, were not with American units, but I did operate and go out on a lot of night ambush patrols mm-hmm. and training situations. Now, what I mean by training situations, they were live fire and they were real deals, but we were, part of our reasons for doing them was so they'd be able to do it when we left and they'd know how to do it with our logistical support. Very important, particularly the LPs, the listening posts that you would put out there, and making sure that you have an exit and a way back into your own location, knowing which way to lay out your claymores, knowing how to effectively booby trap those claymores so that if the enemy picked them up out there, he couldn't turn them on you, which they've been known to do. Knowing how to maintain radio silence, having signals for not speaking, but only clicking your handset. All of those things were very critical and very important to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure you can only teach the basics of something like that in a garrison situation or in a training situation like you would have in the States. Human nature being what it is, you can learn how to do it there,
mm-hmm.
but you don't understand the need for it until you're in country in the combat situation, and that's why most units tried very hard to have a 5-day training exercise at least for new replacements when they first came in country, because you take it a lot more seriously once you're there.
Yeah,
but I think they laid down the basics of it pretty much. It's very important, defensive positions. Now, there seems to be some controversy, and I don't know that much about it since I didn't serve in American units, about the digging in and how it's very important that you dig in. But I also know a lot of units that just didn't have the time to get much more than a shallow sleep position thing, that they couldn't really didn't have a lot of time to get down into a foxhole situation every single night.
Mm-hmm.
That's what any good field grade officer would always want his battalion to be able to dig in every night and to get your men below so that the only danger that a man has of being killed is if there's a direct mortar hit on his foxhole. Other than that, he's able to fight from a recessed position. But the Army, they tried. I mean, I think fire and maneuver hasn't changed that much from World War II in open ground warfare. But I think they did a good job with it.
Okay, very good. Ron, tell me about how you saw your relationship and how you developed the relationship with the people in your unit through your training, basic, and then in AIT, and the dynamics of that.
Yeah, I did have a lot of friends in AIT, and they were all people that were going on with me to OCS, and we had really strong, we pledged to each other that we'd stay friends through OCS and us, because we knew that was going to be pretty tough. And some of that didn't happen, but we did. I did have a pretty good bunch of friends. I even had a couple of friends who I made arrangements with that when we went to OCS, we would bring our wives to OCS and they would live together, and which they did.
How many in your AIT were going to go to OCS with you?
In my company of 150 odd, let's say, mm-hmm. I don't remember the exact number, but let's say a company of 150, there was about 70 of us that were going to OCS. They put us all in this one company. And so when we got to OCS, our 150, it was at least half of us knew each other from AIT. Excuse me. And then there was another group that came from, I believe, where else was it? Maybe it was Pope. Maybe it was just another company at Pope. So that when we got to Benning, there was, and this was at Thanksgiving, of 1968, we were scheduled to, we had to be there on Friday morning after Thanksgiving, is how they scheduled us to start at CS in Fort Benning. So we all show up, and we the night before, we'd all come in on Wednesday night of Thanksgiving, most of us, and then we went to the Howard Johnson's there at Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia, and got drunk and watched football, watched the Texas A&M Texas football game. I do remember that. And then we were to go to camp the next, or go to Benning the next morning and report in at 0700. Well, we got there, and they said to us,
at Howard Johnson?
Or no, this was at, this was on post. We went to Fort Benning. We'd spent the night at the Howard Johnson.
Okay, so you're
on our own.
You're out of Louisiana. You're gone from Fort Polk.
Right.
You're
right. I actually had gone home for 2 weeks. No, for probably a week. Back to Detroit. Went back to Detroit, yeah.
What was your family like when you came back up there?
They noticed a big change in me. I was bigger. I was stronger. I cussed a lot.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah. This MBA from Wayne State University had forgotten how to talk.
Did they tell you that then, or have they told since?
No, they told me that then. My poor mother.
Yeah. She'd say, "Ron, stop."
Yeah, watch your family. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I was a changed man. I had really become a soldier. And
were you in uniform?
I came home in uniform, and that may have been. I don't remember that I wore my uniform anywhere other than coming in. I remember a neat thing though. I was flying home from Fort Polk, and I remember being on the airplane. I went through Atlanta, as I recall, and a man was flying up from the Bahamas, and I remember sitting next to him on the plane, and he was very nice, and I remember him saying to me, "Do you want, son? Would you like my roll?" You know, we had little meals, and I was just so hungry, and I had scarfed mine down in no time. He was saying, "Son, would you like my roll?" And I said, "I sure would." And so I ate his roll, and I thought to myself, you know, 6 months ago I wouldn't have cared to eat his roll, but I was a soldier now, and I was hungry all the time, but. I don't remember that. I think on that particular trip, I had really good experiences. Met Maxine at the airport, went home, and all that. Spent a week back there and getting ready to go to OCS because we were only going to get a week between because that's when our school started. Mm-hmm. And the plan was that when we got out of when we'd go to OCS and we'd have about 4 weeks there. Or 3 or 4 weeks there, and then we'd be given about a 10-day leave for Christmas. Mm-hmm. So that's why we didn't get a very long leave. Now, guys that were going to Vietnam got either 2 weeks or a full 30 days before they went to Vietnam as they left Fort Polk. But we were scheduled. We had a duty station to go to. Mm-hmm. So we reported in there at Benning at that 0700. And we were all standing in line there and knowing, and we had heard so many bad things about OCS. Infantry OCS, and it was going to be so tough. And no matter what we thought we had gone through that was hard, this was going to be so much harder.
Harder than
physically,
Tigerland.
Oh, yeah. Tigerland was stressful because it was supposed to be like Vietnam, but this was going to be 6 months. I mean, we'd been through, we had been only 4 months in the Army, and now we were going to be 6 months. In addition to what we had just done. And so OCS, Benning OCS was known to be really tough. So we were prepared for tough, and we were prepared for a lot of harassment starting in that morning, because there was harassment at basic, but there was no harassment at AIT, mm-hmm. and we were ready to start over, so we were pretty much prepared for that. So the very first morning, they came out, and they said, "Gentlemen, we have some good news and some bad news. The bad news is your OCS class is not going to start today. The Pentagon has made a mistake in putting your group together, and we will not be able to start your OCS until January the 7th.
And that's the bad news.
That's the bad news. The good news is, since you're here at Fort Benning, home of the Airborne, you all have the opportunity to go to airborne training before you go to OCS.
Wow.
No way in my mind was I planning on jumping out of an airplane. It wasn't even anywhere on the radar screen that I would jump out of an airplane.
Yeah.
I'd only ridden on him one, three times.
Right, right.
What's this all about? So they said, now you don't have to make that decision this morning, but you do have to make the decision tomorrow. And your choices are these. If you choose to go to airborne school, you will have 3 weeks of airborne training, after which you will go back to your homes and you will be given, I think it was like 3 weeks or almost a month of leave. And while you are in airborne training, we will promote you to E5, which would be the rank you would have in OCS.
Mm-hmm.
But our rank is only E2 or E3. I was in E3. I was a PFC. I'd been promoted for some reason. And so they said, so you will make more money while you're jumping out of airplanes. And you will be given this longer leave. If you choose not, because they can't, airborne is one of the few things in the Army they can't force you to do. They can't force you to be a tunnel rat. They can't force you to jump out of an airplane. If you choose to not jump out of airplanes, not become airborne qualified, you will be assigned to casual company. You will pull KP for the OCS classes for the next 5 weeks, in which case you will get 1 week for Christmas.
And you're thinking the airplanes are sounding better.
Oh, yeah. It's still something about jumping on airplanes. It's a little scary.
Yeah.
Now, today we will take you down to the airborne training place, and Colonel, head of the Airborne Brigade, will talk to you and we'll show you films. We'll do all these things to show you what airborne is all about. So we went to this whole thing all day long, going to all these different stations to learn how to do all these things, and the great films of the combat jumps in World War II and everything, you know. Well, that night we all talked about it because we all knew each other. The 70 of us all knew each other. And
how does 70 of you sit and talk about this?
Not all 70 of us, one, but just we went to the bar. We went to the bar and we, you know, different tables of people, different cliques of groups. My good friends were probably 7 or 8 of us.
Do you remember their names? I mean, who?
Oh, yeah. Bob Turner, George Cunningham, Tex Latimer. Tex, I don't know Tex's first name, but his name was Tex. I remember he was from Nacogdoches.
Tex Latimer.
David Snell from Greenville, Mississippi. Bob LeClaire. Bob McDonald. Stuchel. Gary Stuchel. Golly, these names are coming to me. Yeah, terrific people. Just terrific people. And all of us had the same problem. Why the hell would we want to do this? Every single one of us was a college graduate. We were all older than the average person. And they were telling us that we were going to give us the chance to go jump out of airplanes or pull KP. And we really couldn't decide what we wanted to do. So my buddy Bob Turner, who was kind of the big athlete guy of the group, Bob was from Oregon,
mm-hmm.
Eugene, Oregon, and he was a great athlete. He may have even played some college ball. He was really a good friend, kind of my idol, you might say. In fact, our wives ended up living together there at Fort Benning. Bob said, I'm going. I'm doing it. I'm going to jump out of airplanes. He said, why not? He said, just think of what that would give, you know, what a morale boost that would be. And then we got to thinking, hey, if we all went, how cool would that be to be an airborne qualified OCS company? The whole company, or virtually the whole company, be airborne qualified. None of our TAC officers probably will be airborne qualified. we would be something they aren't. So that would really be neat. Mm-hmm. So we kind of were all pretty close to making that decision that we're going to go ahead and do it. Mm-hmm. And go take that long leave back home and be able to get those shiny Cochran's and wear them home and everything. That was going to be really neat. So the next morning, they called the formation, and the colonel from the Airborne Brigade came down. Mm-hmm. And he had already talked to us day before, and he stood out there in the formation, and he told us all how important it was that we make the right decision and everything. And then he said, all right, everyone who is too chicken shit to jump out of airplanes, take one step forward. And you look up and down the line to see, because he's not asking for volunteers, he's asking for who's too chicken shit do it. Yeah. And we look up and down the line, and out of this company of about 150, I believe 10 took one step forward, and 140 of us committed to do a jump out of airplanes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good decision?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I just enjoyed every minute. I mean, not every minute, but I really did like jumping out of airplanes. Absolutely, because it was the right decision for a whole lot of reasons that followed. One is, I after OCS, I got assigned the 82nd Airborne Division, which I would not have been able to do had I not been airborne qualified.
Sure.
It was a great first assignment. It was also good physically for preparing us for OCS, because the physical training in OCS, or in airborne every morning, was to go out and do the airborne shuffle for 5 miles, and it did build up our legs very well. The only downside of it was, airborne was very popular at that time of the cycle, because everybody, so enlisted men were going to get $65 a month more, and officers get $110 a month more, which on an officer's salary at that time was 25% more. You're making $400, you're getting $110 in addition to that for jumping out of airplanes. $65 is an enlisted man against a salary probably of about, I don't know, 150 or something, I don't recall exactly. So, and then we're going to get our promotion to E5, so we're going to make that money for that period of time. So that was kind of good.
Did you talk to Maxine about this at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what happened was, I called home the night that I was going to make the decision the next morning, and I talked to her, and I said, honey, I said, I'm going to, you know, sit down, you're going to be surprised at this, but I said, I'm volunteering to jump out of airplanes. And she said, oh no, what are you doing that for? Why? So I explained it to her, and she was fine with it. Then I called my father and told my dad. And my dad said, are you sure that's wise? He said, you know, he said, I remember when you were a boy how you used to faint all the time when you'd hit your knee. And he said, you know, that's the reason that we never let you play football. And that's the reason that you didn't do a lot of those rough things that other boys did, is you have this sensitive knee. And I remember one or two times passing out, and you hit a knee, you know, it was like a funny bone thing or something. So you tell me all these reasons why I shouldn't do it. And he said, you know, if you hit your knee going out of that plane or something, that could be really bad. This is one of several discussions my father and I would have about dangerous things in life, followed by one about riding motorcycles. But anyway, we talked about it, and I said, well, Dad, I'm going to do it anyway. I said, my theory on this thing is that if I end up going to Vietnam, I want to have all the training that I can possibly have, and this is just one more step in that, so I'm going to do it. So he was fine with that. He just wanted to point out to me that maybe there were some things that I didn't know about what it was like when I was growing up or something. So we jumped. And
you got to describe the first time, what that was like, mentally, emotionally for you.
We were jumping, first of all, because of there being so much of a need for, not a need, argue if there was ever a need, because we don't use that as a delivery system in combat very much, but there were so many men wanting to go to airborne training that they were jumping every kind of plane that they could, and we jumped C-119s. Yeah, think about that. This is 1968, and we made four jumps out of a C-119 and one out of a C-130.
Why the 119?
I don't know for sure. I assume it was because they couldn't either get anything else, everything else was committed, or it may have been because of weather. I don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. No one really told us. But we got the weather got real bad. It got cold, it got windy, and it was a real problem, and our jumps kept being put off in our final week. You're supposed to make 5 jumps the last week, one each day. We ended up making 3 on Wednesday, 2 on Thursday, and 1 on Friday. And
well,
only the Friday jump was a C-130. The other 4 were all C-119s.
Explain the difference to those listening.
Okay, a C-119 is a really old aircraft. I don't even know the vintage of it, but it looked old then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was loud and noisy, and it's not... well, it's put like this. A C-47, it would be a luxury liner compared to a C-119. A C-47 is the same as a DC-3 commercial plane. A C-119, I don't even know it has an equivalent. It's 2-engine, maybe 4-engine, and it has 2 pipes coming back to a tail, and it's small. The stick, that's what they call the units of jumping, was probably no more than 30 men. Oh, it was noisy and loud.
We call it the flying boxcar.
A flying boxcar, that's a good description, yeah. And I can remember we had this one on the 4th jump, which would be the first jump of the 2nd day, because we'd done 3 in 1 day. One of the guys that I was sitting next to on the plane going up said to me, "This will be my 4th time in an airplane." He was from Kentucky, and
uh-huh.
He'd ridden to basic training on a bus,
uh-huh.
And he'd ridden to AIT on a bus. He said, "This will be my 4th time on an airplane, and I've never landed." Yeah, 4th time taking off, and I've never landed. I thought,
wow,
that's pretty cool.
Wow.
Pretty cool. So we made our jumps, and then we had this graduation ceremony, and we were awarded our wings. We went out the night before and bought these. You can only wear Cochrane boots. You're supposed to only be able to wear Cochrane jump boots if you are airborne qualified. And so we got our wings. And so then they said, okay, now, so we graduated. I guess I have my days off by 1 or 2 here, and it was in the week. But anyway, they said, now tomorrow you report to OCS, and we will admit you, and then you go on leave for your long period.
Mm-hmm.
So we all checked in, and we all had we put our greens on, and we put our shiny Cochrane boots on, and we had our wings, and we went and reported in. And it was terrible. OCS, first day of OCS, even though it was our first and our last day, because
mm-hmm.
we were just going to be sworn in. The TAC officers and the military establishment there, the company commander, there wasn't one airborne qualified. Company commander had never jumped. None of the TAC officers had jumped. They were all legs. And here they had this company of 140 of us, 90% of us were airborne qualified. And we were standing there looking so good in our greens and our Cochranes and our wings. And they made us take them. They sent us back to the barracks and made us take off our wings, made us take off our jump boots, and put on our low quarters, because they said, "You may be airborne qualified, but you will not be able to wear any of that while in OCS."
Oh, wow.
Oh, it bothered us so much. Really bothered us a lot. So that's what we did. And they told us that we had to put your candidate stuff on, because we go from being, you know, just being E5s to being OCS bars, and the very lowest level that you can be as a first week. And so they said, "You will not ever be able to wear this stuff until you are commissioned for 6 months.
Why do you think they did that?
I think they wanted to knock us down a peg. You're not supposed to walk into OCS feeling good about yourself. You're supposed to be scared shitless.
Right.
We weren't. We had just done something that none of us had planned to do, and we had done stuff that none of the TAC officers had done. None of the TAC officers had been to Vietnam. The company commander was Vietnam experienced, but none of the TAC officers were. And so they didn't have anything on us. us. That's the way we took it. We had so much confidence going into OCS, and they didn't like that. They knew it was going to be like that, and I imagine there was a battalion meeting at which they said, hey, you know this company, this 66 OC company that's coming in here? These boys think they're really hot stuff because they just went to airborne. We've got to knock them down a few pegs before they go home for Christmas. So they did. They knocked us down a few pegs.
Were you, you were pissed off?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, you can't show it, so
right.
We did. So we all, so afterwards we all got on, you know, once we were dismissed for the holidays, we all went, we had our duffel bags. We couldn't get out with, we had to go through the orderly there, and we couldn't get out dressed any way like, but allow, the way they would allow us to. And then we all took our Cochran's in our bags, and when we got to the airport, we changed back into our Cochran's. Because, man, I was going to wear those jump boots home. That was, and that is the one time that I remember coming home from the Army and really feeling good about myself, really feeling proud because I had done something. And it made me even feel maybe better about the fact that my father had said, maybe you shouldn't do this. He hadn't said, don't do it, because he knew I was an adult. But I think it was my way of showing him that I could do something that maybe he didn't ever expect me to. And I would do a whole lot of other things in my military career that he would have never expected me to, but this was one of the first.
Yeah.
And I was proud of it. I really was.
It sounds like that was deserved, you know, that you all went out on this limb and did this. I want to ask you two questions before we wrap up today.
Okay.
And this is something that I wanted to ask you a little while back. Has to do with Tigerland, very quickly. Have you seen the movie Tigerland?
Yes.
Excellent. How does it compare?
I think it's a great movie. I show it in my classes. I think the metamorphosis at the end of the movie, when Colin Farrell's character that's been this kind of smartass for the whole film, figuring out a way to avoid service in Vietnam, you know, he's smarter than all of the people training him and everything. And then all of a sudden at Tigerland, we see the cadre that has served in Vietnam saying to him, all I'm trying to do is keep you alive, and you don't get it. All this action, all these things you're doing that are funny and make you feel good about yourself, none of that's going to be important in a few weeks when you're in Vietnam. You better start paying attention. Mm-hmm. And you see, and it's not, there's no political statement. The guys aren't arguing the whether we should be there or not. You know, he's questioned some of the atrocious behavior that he sees them trying to teach and all that. The guy says, you can forget all of that. That's not important once you're there. What's important once you're there is staying alive and keeping your men alive. And you see this almost this look on Colin Farrell's face. And yeah, I guess I've missed. I may have hadn't been paying attention for 7 weeks, and he has this change. I think that's a very good statement about what it was like for soldiers going to Vietnam. That no matter what your political beliefs were, no matter whether you thought the war was a good idea or a bad idea, at this point it's survival. At this point, it's about figuring out ways to learn. In this next week of Tigerland training, learn enough to where that'll help you when you get there. So I thought they did a good job at that. I thought the other thing that's good about the film is it really does hammer home what I was saying earlier about the role of the African-American NCO in the training. A lot of white guys owe their survival to being trained by African-American NCOs in basic and AIT. I still believe that. And I always try to put that into my lectures, in addition to you get through that whole thing about racism, and everybody knows that early in the war a lot of black guys died at a greater percentage of the population than they should have and all that stuff. But I said, I don't want you to forget this, that a lot of black guys saved a lot of white guys' lives because they were so effective when they re-upped and they stayed in to teach the skills that they had learned, because there's a percentage that was higher than the white percentage also.
Okay. I would like for you to describe your first jump out of an airplane. And the reason why I want you to kind of think back what you were feeling, what you saw, literally, and that whole process. It's because I think oftentimes when those of us who are on this side are asking these questions about jump school and wanting, you know, airborne training to be described, nine times out of ten, those narrating almost skip through that part like it's second nature. It's not a big deal because you've done it, you've mastered it, you've gone forward, and plus it's been quite a long time ago.
Right.
But those listen to this, and including myself, to personalize this, it's hard to imagine what that might be like and how you deal with that individually. And I know that probably is personality dependent, but I think it's relevant to have on record some description of what that's like, and especially for people listening to this in the near future who might be going through the exact same thing, but also those listening in the distant future who want to know what it was like. How were American soldiers trained in airborne tactics, and what was the mentality in the 1960s, in the middle of the 20th century, in America's longest war? What happened? So, if you don't mind, could you kind of think back about that day and what happened to you and what you went through?
Well, as I mentioned, we kept getting our jump put off by weather. The training up to the jump itself consisted of jumping out of 34-foot stationary towers. And then we made either one or two jumps off of what they call the 250-foot tower. You see them at pictures of Fort Benning, a lot of these towers.
Yes.
That, in some ways, was the scariest thing we ever did, because they haul you up as you're hanging. You got your chute on, and they haul you up, and then they drop you. And there's a very significant feeling of dropping, because you're hauled up and then you come straight down. As if there's no prop blast or anything, it's just a straight fall. And there's this NCO screaming at you to make sure that you handle your risers correctly to keep from blowing into the tower. You actually have a thing that if you don't do it right, you will be blown back into the tower. So this NCO is screaming obscenities at you
from the ground.
He's actually about halfway up.
Okay,
he's probably at the 100-foot level, so he's sort of midway between where you're going to fall and where you have been taken from.
Loudspeaker. Oh, okay. Did they tell you that beforehand?
Oh, absolutely. But it's more fun to scream at you when you're in the air. And they scream at you, and the one thing I did know is I went back to Fort Benning a couple of years ago to when I was doing my dissertation research, and I was on my motorcycle, and I parked underneath the tower, and I watched and listened, and boy, have they cleaned it up.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, now 50% of the classes are women, and they've got a whole different attitude. I didn't hear one cuss word.
Really?
Not one cuss word. Of course, it's being broadcast over the whole... fort, you can hear it.
But wasn't the same thing?
Oh, yeah, exact same thing. Nothing's changed. Even the parachute's no different. It's still a T-10 parachute. Yeah.
What were they saying to you all?
Well, they tell you as they bring you up, you know, remember that when you're dropped, you've got to remember that your rear risers, your front risers, your right, your left. You got to remember where the wind's coming from. Right now, we have a windsock up there, and you can see that the windsock is going this direction.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that if you're being pulled into the tower, that you use your left. You know, just that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But then when they drop you, it's just scream, scream, scream. And I remember it just being scary as it could be, that part. Really scary. Almost to the point of I thought, jumping out of an airplane will be easier than this, because there's no tower to blow into. So when I went into the aircraft, when I was going to make my first jump, I had bad memories of the tower.
You did okay with the tower jump?
Yeah, I did okay, but it was scary. It really was. They screamed and yelled at me. I remember that. I don't remember exactly how personal that got, but I know it was. I think we had a couple of guys blow into the tower. Nobody got hurt, but got a little close to it, you know. And so,
did you pack your own chute?
No. You have someone pack. There is a parachute packing MOS.
Right.
So I remember going to the first jump and being scared, but not all that scared, because it kept cutting. Put off. Finally, they said, okay, today's the day we're going to make the jump, 9 o'clock in the morning, make the first jump. And the companies were so big in OCS, that they had to start feeding us. We would start our training at 7 in the morning, and the first chow line was at 3.
Wow.
You could literally go eat and go home and go back and sleep for 3 hours. Didn't have anything else to do until 7, but you could eat at 3. It was just wow. So, but it was also kind of realized. The other neat thing about airborne training, I remember, is that there was no rank in airborne training. If you were a major, you slept in the barracks with the privates. And if you were, and they would drop down and give me 10 if you were a major, or if you were a private, it was the same thing. And there was a lot of, there were several field grade officers. We had, I remember in our unit, we had a chaplain. He was a captain. He was a chaplain. He was a pretty neat guy. So you got older men, you know, guys that were way up in their 40s and stuff like that, you know, that were,
wow,
that were in the thing with us. But I do remember that, eating it really early in the morning. And then being hungry all day and having to go eat honey buns whenever you could get them and all that kind of stuff. So I do remember, though, the first jump, and I was not in the front of the stick. I was probably somewhere in the middle of the stick, as opposed to later jumps that I would make, because when I was in the 82nd Airborne Division, I was Pathfinder Platoon Leader for our overseas exercises, so I always got to be the first one out of the plane. Mm-hmm. And I made two other jumps of the 82nd where I was the first one out of the plane, which is just as cool as it gets, because you get to stand in the door for a long time until the green light goes on. So, but I do remember that I was in the middle of the stick, and it was a matter of and the funny thing is, I've watched Band of Brothers, and it hadn't changed from World War II. Check equipment, you know, link up, stand up, hook up. Check equipment, and you check the man's equipment in front of you, and the man behind you checks your equipment, make sure nothing's tangled, make sure that your static line comes out and it's hooked properly at the top, and that you put your cotter pin through it so that everything is proper that way. And then sound off, and then you count off 1, 2, 3, 4, so everybody's saying that you have checked all your stuff and that you're ready to jump. And it, like I say, it's the same instructions that they're doing. They were doing them at least in 68, or 69, 68, yeah. I assume they're still doing it the same way today when they jump. I mean, I'm sure they're not jumping 119s anymore. And then the command goes out, stand in the door. And the first person in the stick will literally shuffle to the edge. And you don't walk, you shuffle. And place your hands on the side of the aircraft and stand there and look at the green light and wait for the red light to turn green.
And the light's down by your hand level?
It's on, it's right here.
And you're pointing kind of to your watch on
your
left wrist.
Yes, you're looking out and it's right there and you're watching. And then there's a jump master standing right behind you. And as soon as the green light goes on, he'll slam you on the helmet. And that's your signal to go, even though the green light is also the signal.
What if you hesitate?
Wow, I have no idea if you're the first guy out. If you hesitate and you're in the rear, the jump master will pull you back. So I would assume if you were to hesitate as the first man out the door, they would pull you off. Because you have to keep the jump going because you have only a limited amount of time over that drop zone.
Right.
So I would assume that I never took jump master training. A lot of my friends did, but I never became jump master qualified. But I assume there's an instruction on what you would do, whether it's to cut the static cord and pull you back, or exactly what it is, I don't know. And then it's just a matter of going out as fast as you can, and you are immediately hit as you go out the door. On every plane except a jet. Now, when you jump a jet, like a C-141, which is what we jumped when we went to NATO exercises, on every plane except a jet, you feel tremendous prop flash. You don't even have a sense of falling. You come out of the aircraft, you push off, and you come out, and this wind, just like that, and it blows your body sideways.
Is it a circular wind, or like just a gust?
It's a gust of wind. It's like, I don't even know how you would describe it. Maybe like opening the door of a car at 90 miles an hour or something. You know, just like that, and your body goes like this. It goes sideways, and from the wind, and you're blown in that direction, and you never have a sense of falling until your chute opens because of that wind.
Really?
Yeah. There's no sense of falling. Except when you jump a 141. On a 141, because of the speed of the plane, you have a windshield that stands out like this. You're going in this direction. It's blocking the wind. So when you jump out of a jet, a C-141, I've never jumped a C-5A, but I'm sure it's the same kind of thing. When you jump out, you do have a sense of falling because there is sort of a vacuum that's created, and you come out and you fall. And that's, in a sense, the adrenaline rush is greater that way. And then I also jumped Hueys. And the Huey is the greatest jump of all. Now, we're jumping the C-119s. We're jumping them at probably 12 to 1,300 feet. It's a low-level thing. When you jump a C-141, I think you're jumping 1,500. When you jump a helicopter, you jump 2,000. When you jump a helicopter, you're sitting down, just like I'm sitting exactly like now. And you have your feet like this. The jump master is standing behind you, and the chopper takes you out over the drop zone, and you're sitting with your hands like this, and there's no green light or anything.
And your hands are, just to describe, you're on the edge of the couch, and your hands are just on the edge of the couch as well,
right,
beside your legs.
You've hooked up to the static line overhead.
Uh-huh.
The drop zone, the jump master standing behind you, and when he gets word from the chopper pilot that they're over the drop zone, I don't recall that there was even a light on the choppers. I made a bunch of jumps on a chopper with the 82nd, but I don't remember the light situation. Anyway, he will slam you on the helmet, and you push yourself right off, just like this. And what a sensation of falling, because you're hovering.
Yeah.
Oh, just straight down. It's the neatest. It's the best jump that you'll do. Now, I never got a chance to free fall. I never did that. I tried to do it one time, and it didn't work out and in a sports situation. But so I don't know that feeling of free falling, which I still want to do someday.
Mm-hmm.
I'm young enough to still want to do that, I guess. But I will do that someday. But I loved it. Loved everything about it. Jumping was... After the first jump, I couldn't wait till the second jump.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, when that prop wash first hit you, what were you feeling that first time? You're like, oh my God, this is not what they were describing. This is exactly...
No, I'll tell you what I remember is once the prop wash was gone, it was over, and that lasts about 2 seconds, the idea of what happens is you jump, and then you start counting. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, and at 5,000, you look up. Check, make sure that your chute is open, that there's not a Mae West situation where you have a riser going over your canopy.
Why do they call it a Mae West situation?
Because it looks like a brassiere.
Okay.
So once you check, and if everything, and if it's open, then you're fine. If it's not, if you have a Mae West or if your chute hasn't opened somehow, then you reach down and pull your reserve, and you only have 4 more seconds to get your reserve deployed without having to worry about a malfunction and a disaster.
Did you ever have anybody in your class?
Saw one. That was later, though. That was with the 82nd Airborne Division, the St. Mary Glees drop zone at Fort Bragg. We had a guy chute never opened. He crashed and burned, as we say.
And died?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a pretty, pretty bad situation. That's the only time I ever saw a real bad situation. I saw lots of guys break legs and stuff, and we jumped into Turkey one time. That comes later with the 82nd. Anyway, what I noticed the most on that jump was the tremendous peace and quiet. The plane's gone, and you are all by yourself.
How spread out are you?
Well, the C-119, as I recall, had like really small sticks, either 30 or 60, I don't remember, as opposed to like 90, 120 in the larger planes. So you don't have, and you're spread out because the time and everything getting out. So you see guys over here, and people are making noise and stuff, but not much. And as you get more experience, you just enjoy the solitude, the quietness so much Same thing, I used to, later in the 82nd, I would make night jumps, and they were just the neatest thing in the world to jump at night, because not only is it quiet, but it's, you can see out over the horizon. Say night, we jump at like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock right after, and you just look out and just be so peaceful and quiet. That's what I know. For about 5 minutes, you are in your own world. You're in charge of your own destiny. You can move whichever direction you feel that you want to do with your risers. And it's so peaceful and quiet. Just really, really a neat feeling. I loved it. I just absolutely loved it.
Mm. Wow. And you took to it.
Oh, yeah. 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 So when I got my orders for 82nd later on, I was like, whoa, I get to do this again. Because I wouldn't make any more jumps between the time I made my fifth jump and the time I got that I was sent to the 82nd was all OCS, and we didn't jump at all. And so when I got my orders for the 82nd, I didn't even look beyond like where I mean, I knew Fort Bragg, but I thought, whoa, I'm going to get to this again. And I did a lot.
Yes.
It was really neat. Yeah, I loved it. Loved every minute of it.
Okay. So we've got you going to OCS is where we are. You're going to go home for 5 weeks and go through, I guess, December of 68.
Yeah, we actually, I think our class started about January 7th of 69. Okay. And I would go home, get my wife and a U-Haul trailer and haul a bunch of stuff down there and set her up at the Camellia Apartments.
And this is at Benning?
At Fort Benning. It's in Columbus, Georgia, the Camellia Apartments off post. And become a member of the 4th Platoon of the 66 OCS Company.
Okay, why don't we stop today?
That's good.
We'll pick up there next time.
All right.